Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
So good evening, welcome everyone. Great to have you here. For those of you in the theater and for those of you online, welcome as well. My name's Peter Tribowitz. I'm a professor in the International Relations Department. I'm the director of the Fallon United States Center here on campus, which has organized this event on anti-globalism, international disorder, and the West. Well, here we are. We meet at a time of, renewed pessimism in Western capitals about the future of the liberal order, the strong performance of populist, anti-globalist parties in the European parliamentary elections earlier this week. It was a wake-up call, I think, for those who thought that populism and economic nationalism was on the ropes, you know, in retreat in the West. And meanwhile, across the pond, Donald Trump, considered all but dead, I think, after the January 6th insurrection in 2021, is anything but. His America First brand of anti-globalism remains very popular in parts of the United States, and as we saw yesterday among many Republicans on Capitol Hill. In putting tonight's panel together, I was keen to bring together a group of, a set of speakers who have thought a lot about populism, anti-globalism, its roots, its causes, and its implications for Western democracies, but also the larger international order. And so we have with us, starting from in the green from my left, Helen Thompson, a professor of international political economy at the University of Cambridge, and the author of Disorder, Hard Times in the 21st Century. Gideon Rachman, chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times, and author of The Age of the Strongmen. And Leslie Vinjamori, the director of the U.S. and the Americas program at Chatham House, a professor of international relations at SOAS, and co-editor of Anchoring the World. So welcome to all of you. It's great to have you here. So Helen, let's go ahead and start with you. Please join me in welcoming. So Helen, let's go ahead and we pick straws, and we're going to start with Helen. So you've written a book on international disorder. So I guess the question for you maybe is kind of how should we think about anti-globalism? I mean, should we think about it as a driver of international disorder, or is it, you know, should we think about it maybe as a symptom of international disorder?
I think the obvious answer, Peter, is that it's both, but it's both in a quite complicated way, I think. I think that it's really interesting in trying to make sense of how we've got to the danger that Trump represents now, to think back to what things were like in 2015, 16, so the context for his candidacy the first time, and then to think about the response of the Biden administration in office to that challenge. And I think what you can say is that there were two things, both connected in a way to globalization, one more overtly, I think, than the other, that were central to Trump's ability, in the first instance, I think, really to win the Republican nomination, because that, in a way, is the crucial part of this story. Is one was the border with Mexico and unauthorized migration over that border. And he used that particularly effectively, I think, as an issue in the Republican nomination in winning it. And the second was the China question. He was the confront China candidate. And he was very much presenting that in terms of a critique. I mean, maybe that's not quite the word to use to describe Trump's vocabulary, but anyway, an attack on globalization and China being at the center of that. And in his mind, in his presentation, the US getting screwed by that, and US workers getting screwed by that. And when he came into office, January 2018, I think it was, he started the trade war. Started off quite small, putting tariffs on solar panels and washing machines. You're into a fairly major trade war with a technological sideshow to it by the end of his presidency. Now, I think if you then think about the Biden approach, it has been to say, look, we are going actually to accept his critique of the China issue and the US relationship to Chinese trade, investment in China by American companies. Indeed, we're not only going to double down on it, we're going to go significantly further, because our signature domestic commitment, the energy transition, we are going to say has to take place on terms that is a bulwark against Trump to reshore American industrial manufacturing. That's the bet that the Biden administration made. So it accepted really the end of the liberal international trade in order, in a rules-based sense, in order to do that. And it's had certain successes, but it hasn't stopped Trump coming back. Now, you might say that's because it's quite a hard thing to do to reindustrialize America in a relatively short period of time, but it's also, I think, because the Biden administration has not really wanted to shift position on the border question, on the Mexican border question. We see much higher levels of migration across the border. And what now, I think, and this is the last thing I'll say about America, is really revealing about what's happened in the last year, is the way in which not only Trump, but other people in the Republican Party, including at one point Mitt Romney, tied the Mexican border question to the Ukraine question. So that is the reason why there was no funding for Ukraine, new funding for Ukraine for a good 6 months. Because the Republican position, driven by Trump, but accepted by most of the Republican Party, was to say, we can't support Ukraine whilst we've got a border crisis. And that's the terrain, I think, in which he's still got a lot of political mileage. And what then he does about the Ukraine question, if he were to be elected, becomes the actual big threat to the international order. Because the rules-based trade one, I think, is already gone. Is it possible to keep the alliances of NATO and in Asia, NATO plus, so that would include the Quad countries, India, Australia and Japan as well, together in the face of a Trump presidency?
That's great. And you've actually kind of picked up on something that, Gideon, I want to ask you about. I cheated, Gideon. I was looking at the most recent podcast that you have out, and it's on Macron's decision to call a snap election. And one of the things that strikes me about that decision is very often what the center-right and the center-left are doing is trying to co-opt the far-right, in particular, their position. And so in a way, that's, you could say that's kind of what Biden did with the trade question vis-a-vis China. And also, I think the Democrats have really moved towards the hardcore Republican position on immigration. So the question I have, Macron is doing something different. He's pushing back, it seems to me. And it's kind of like a high stakes, maybe high payoff strategy. Thoughts about that? Is it an inflection point? Is this?
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll know in 2 weeks' time, so perhaps that. But I have the feeling it's already going quite badly wrong, to be honest. But we'll see. I mean, I think the far right probably will come out as the biggest party in France. Whether they then form the government will depend on the precise numbers. But I mean, I thought Helen set it out really well. I was thinking in the French context, though. I remember seeing Marine Le Pen in the last presidential election going to a press conference where she set out her foreign policy position. Yeah. And it strongly reminded me of the discourse in Britain around the period of Brexit and the discourse in America with Trump, in the sense that it was very much, you know, France is a great nation, but we've sort of betrayed ourselves. We don't understand how important we are around the world. We've traded away our kind of birthright, and we should reassert French greatness. It was make France great again, just as it was sort of make Britain great again, was Brexit, make America great again. in the US. I think America has a better chance, to be honest. I think that one of the reasons that you've had a, you know, now in the UK, 70% saying Brexit has failed is because that agenda doesn't seem to have delivered. But I think we're going to see a French effort to do that if Le Pen wins. And it is tied, as Helen pointed out, to a backlash against globalization or globalism, as they call it. Globalization is used, you know, as a relatively sort of bloodless technical term. Globalism, in these people's idea, is a sort of ideology imposed by a ruthless cosmopolitan elite which is lining their own pockets, betraying normal people. And that is something that Trump has worked against, that I think Le Pen is going to try to work against. Because of the size of its economy, the US, you know, and the relatively less importance of trade to the American economy has a better chance of doing that sort of thing. I think Britain has discovered the difficulties of cutting itself off from its major market, and you're already seeing the markets begin to take fright at the kinds of things that Le Pen might do. It's interesting that as part of her context of de-demonisation, I think probably the key move she's made is to stop saying that she'll take France out of the euro, which may have helped lose her the first presidential run with Macron. So I think a question I'll kind of leave you with, though, is I suspect that for, you know, us and most people in the audience, the kinds of policies that Trump, Le Pen, etc. propose on migration, which again is crucial, are not palatable. The question is, are they inherently authoritarian? You know, are these people a threat to democracy? So when we say far right, are we talking 1930s? Or are we just talking a kind of recasting of conservatism, moving what conservatism means? I mean, Trump has clearly done that in the United States. The old Republican Party of free trade, internationalism, basically no longer exists, barely. He's turned it into a protectionist, nationalist, isolationist party. I think he's also an authoritarian. Obviously, we saw that in the response to the 2020 presidential election. Are the European far right like that? You know, we don't yet know. Some say Meloni is sort of behaving herself in Italy, although I know a lot on the Italian left believe that there's a hidden agenda which will emerge in due course. Mm-hmm. And Le Pen, you know, Trump seems to be becoming more radical with time. Le Pen obviously has been moving slightly in the opposite direction, trying to make herself move into the centre ground. Again, whether that is a ruse, and you know, the real French far right will emerge if they gain power, we'll only discover if and when they do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I think Trump kind of set the bar higher yesterday in that meeting with the Republican caucus, because he called for an end to the income tax and a return to tariffs as the source of income. This was a Republican Party position in the 1890s. So, yeah, I mean, this is a big change, right? Yeah. And of course, tariffs are not progressive at all, right? They're mostly people down below.
And incidentally, it's just last thought on migration. I mean, I think it's interesting that Meloni is already saying, look, I've tried to deliver, it's really, really hard, et cetera, et cetera. I think the fear is, and you'll know this, is that Trump will really deploy the army to start rounding up illegal migrants. And, he said he'll deport, up to 1 million people or more. And people say, you know, to me, don't dismiss that as mere bluster. He may actually attempt to do it.
Leslie, Trump's obviously the 600-pound gorilla here. So, I mean, you spend a lot of time answering questions about U.S. politics at Chatham House. And so what do you make of the continuing support for him? I mean, is it about his America First agenda? Is it about Trump, to steal Gideon's phrase, Trump the strongman? Is it anti-incumbency right now, kind of? I mean, what is it? Thoughts?
Yeah. first of all, you know, we're looking at polls. First of all, it is great to be here. Thank you very much, Peter. And can I just say that for all those anti-globalists and those nationalists and those populists and those awful, awful people, look at everybody who's turned up on a Friday night. I mean, really, and I have no idea how many people are watching you, Peter, but on a Friday night, it's extraordinary, and I think we need to just remind ourselves of how remarkable it is. A, B, we need to remind ourselves that Donald Trump lost in 2018, he lost in 2020, he lost in 2022, if you consider him, you know, the leader of the Republican Party in all those stages, that there have been continual losses. And on the eve of the U.S. midterm elections in 2022, we talked about the red wave, and we talked about violence on the streets, and we talked about a landslide for the Republicans across Congress, and guess what? We didn't see it. So let's, I mean, I promise you I am deeply concerned, and I don't take it lightly. But A, we have everything to play for, and I actually do mean that, when it comes to democracy. And B, there's lots of evidence to think that this is not a done deal. Polling is certainly concerning. So how would I explain it? Let me walk away from political science. People have a phenomenal ability to compartmentalize. January 6th. Compartmentalization. B, time to event. It's been a while. It's been a long time since January 6th. Been a long time since Trump was in the White House and none of us could get through, you know, 8 hours without kind of our blood pressure going up when we looked at our Twitter feed. But I mean that in a serious way, right? We've forgotten what it means on a daily, hourly basis to live in the UK under a Donald Trump presidency. So time to event, memories fade. And then a year where the sitting president is dealing with two wars, one of which America's position in the war is deeply unpopular for many very important constituencies for the Democrats. Very deeply unpopular, because there is a fundamental contest now within the United States about America's support for Israel. And it is having a very significant effect on how a lot of voters feel about Joe Biden. And so this is a big unknown, not America's support for Israel. That's also something that's going to develop and be contested. But it's a big unknown where voters are on that dimension when we get to November 5th, Tuesday. And they're sitting there in Michigan at, I don't know, name a state university in the north, not the University of Michigan, but a smaller state university that has more diverse, politically diverse population. Are they really going to say, it's fine, let Trump win? I mean, I don't know. Maybe they will. But, so my first point is there's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot to play for. And I guess to add on to that, I was in England on the eve of Brexit with lots of people who didn't want the UK to leave Europe. And I was, you know, with a lot of establishment Brits who didn't want the UK to leave Europe for the weeks leading up to it. And what did they do? They were worried. But what did they do? Did they knock on people's doors? Did they get people out? Did they try to persuade people? No, because they thought it was sort of improper. The people that I talked to thought it was inappropriate to try and influence how people felt about a vote that was radically important for the country. So, you know, I would also add on, there's a lot of agency that you know, the polls are going to turn into questions of agency. So, you know, if we think it's a high-stakes election, and it certainly is in my view, then I think that we need to take the question of agency and democracy very seriously. Why do people, you know, having said that, why is he still popular? Well, I think that, you know, what we've heard, I would say in spades is true, and I would double down on the fact that for whatever reason, even though Joe Biden has done much, much better with the sort of middle, the real lower middle class in British terms, but the middle class in American terms, working class Americans, than Hillary Clinton, for example, it's still not as, his language, his way of engaging is just still not effective with a lot of working class Americans across much of the country. And as we know, inflation is still prices, you know, what you're paying for gas, what you're paying for food, what you're paying on your mortgage or your rent, more likely your rent, is still too high. I feel it, right? And I don't have a financial problem. I feel it. I go in and I buy things in the US and I'm like, I can't believe what it costs. The little things that here just aren't as expensive for some reason. So you can feel it in the prices in your everyday experience in the US. And I think that matters. But again, come back to the election. Women are going to be mobilized. Girls, young women, their boyfriends, their fathers, their brothers, if you don't think that American women and all of those people who support American women aren't going to be taking the Republicans to task as we get closer to the election, then I don't think that you're really listening to what women are experiencing in the United States. The numbers are shocking. And then I guess the final thing I would add on this is, you know, why is Trump so popular? Because the people that should be raising awareness about some of the very difficult consequences aren't doing it. What is corporate America doing? A lot of corporates that we talked to on one of our trips, or our trip to Atlanta during the midterm election, said that they are making sure that their female employees can travel to another state to get an abortion. I think it was the New York Times or one of the papers in the last few days it was extraordinary. They showed where people are going to get an abortion, right? So, that's a nice thing to do for wealthy American women who can afford to, who have been lucky enough to have a good job in a multinational corporation. But, you know, there are a lot of other people that are not there. And I think we will see a lot of single-issue voters, and it will come down to this question of reproductive rights in the United States. So I think there's a lot that will make things look different than they are. But, you know, obviously politics is about alternatives. And people are not seeing on the Democratic side. They're not seeing what they wish to see by way of representing them. We have a very diverse country. They're not feeling inspired, and they're not getting the energy and message that they wish to say, which isn't to say that the policies, many of them, certainly domestically, aren't good and aren't taking in America in a direction that could have very significant payoffs. But it's not what people are feeling right now. They're feeling they're not getting that message.
Gideon, you look like you want to jump.
Oh, it's just listening to Leslie talking. I think also we have to, you know, obviously step out of our liberal bubble every now and then. I remember talking to a friend of mine who works for Biden, and I just said, you know, why are you guys doing so badly? And he just said, people are scared of the American left. Which I thought was quite an interesting insight. That was it. Mm. And I, from what I took away from that is that, you know, just as a lot of people in this room and, you know, are scared of the American right for all the reasons that we know, there are people who think the American left is a threat to them, their interests, their rights, or that they have a radical agenda that they think will change the country in a way they don't like. And at these moments of where the left, for its own reasons, becomes, you know, much more militant, whether it's over Black Lives Matter or Me Too or now Trump or abortion or whatever, they also turn some people off. And I think we have to be aware of that.
I think that that's absolutely right, Gideon. And I think that it's really revealing that in 2020, the Democratic Party establishment ensured in the end that Joe Biden was a candidate. If you go back to before the South Carolina primary, mm-hmm. that would have looked like not unthinkable, because I think there was always a sense that once African-American voters were a significant proportion of the electorate in a Democratic primary, that Joe Biden was going to do better. But if you go back to those early debates prior to Iowa and New Hampshire, he's sort of vacant on the stage. He's just not really there. He's irrelevant, really, to what's happening. He's being attacked by Kamala Harris about his civil rights history.
Yeah.
But after he wins in South Carolina, there's a deliberate move by the party establishment, led probably by Obama, from what one could see from the outside, to get rid of the other centrist candidates and ensure that Biden has got the chance to take on Bernie Sanders by himself and beat him. And that was what the American electorate was offered. You've got the chaos of Trump versus the apparent solidity of Biden. I say apparent because he was campaigning from his basement. It was a pandemic and certain things to do, I think, with, you know, his health were already slightly an issue. But what the events of January the 6th did was to turn Joe Biden's presidency into something that was much more to the left. It was saying, actually, we can take the danger and the horrors of that day and justify Biden going, I'm going the wrong way with my arms, but significantly further to the left than what was elected. Now, in a way, you can say that the radical part of the Biden presidency when it comes to economic policy has come from that and has got the potential payoff, which is the energy transition, the Green Deal, even though Green New Deal, even though it didn't get called that. But there's other aspects of it that I think have proven a mistake in terms of that shift to the left, some of the cultural issues. I think you're right in saying, Peter, that Biden is now moving closer to the Republican position on the border, but that took 2 years to get to that. And before that, it was a radical move to the left.
I agree with that.
On the border. And I think the problem is that once you put the economic strategy for justifying the shift to the left in the context of the energy-driven inflation that came in late 2021 and into 2022, it just became a much, much harder sell. Inflation costs incumbents votes. We can see that across pretty all the, much all these democracies that, that we might talk about. And if you combine that with a set of issues in which there is significant support for the left position, but there's not majority support for it, it's tough. Having said that, I entirely agree with Leslie that this is very, very far from over, including, I would say, because the Republicans have yet to prove that they know organisationally how to do elections with mail-in ballots. They just don't seem thus far to know how you organise in order to do that.
Yeah. Although one of the things, I had a rather chilling conversation with somebody last week from Georgia about the way in which the Republicans have managed to shift the electoral law since then, allow batch challenges to people with African-American names, essentially, and then they have to try to appeal being struck off the ballot, and they may get a day to show up when they're at work and so on. And this person said they didn't think the Democrats can win Georgia now because the shifts have been so dramatic on that.
All right. You know, one thing, I'm going to open it up in a second, but I mean, just to pick up on Trump and the possibility, I think, so for the record, I think Biden's chances are better than a lot of people think. But if Trump wins, my sense when I'm traveling around in Europe is, I mean, this is like the big question, the thing that people are worried about kind of in the, let's say in the foreign policy establishment. If, I think the whole Munich security meeting was basically about the potential, I mean, it wasn't even about Ukraine, it was about the implications of Donald Trump being elected for transatlantic relations, for the whole idea of collective security. And I guess the question I have is, you know, it echoes what we heard after the 2016 election and early in 2017. NATO was in trouble, the transatlantic relations were in trouble. You could argue looking back, I mean, there were certainly a lot of hiccups and there was a lot of angst and so forth, but the wheels didn't come off the bus. And I think the question I have for you as we kind of think about the implications of populism and anti-globalism internationally is there any reason to think it would be different this time? And if so, why? Gideon, you're shaking your head, yes.
Sorry, I don't want to hold the thing. I'm listening to you.
I mean, I'll say something, then come to Gideon. I guess, I mean, we ran a workshop yesterday in which we went through a series of countries and talked about there with some, you know, very great experts, about 13 countries, what is their conception of international order? And what is their, what are the elite form perceptions of America with respect to its foreign policy, and how is it shaping their conception of international order and their role in it? And what was striking was how little people talked about the Trump versus Biden conversation. And when we got to the end, we said, isn't this amazing? We've gone really deep on where, you know, Saudi, Iran, Turkey, Germany, France, you know, we covered a lot of ground. And almost nobody talked about Trump versus Biden, and you know that came back to, well, actually a lot of people think that they've already priced it in, and B, they think that, you know, one way or the other, it's a question of time. America's commitments are changing. America is moving to the Indo-Pacific. China is a number one concern. China is a real concern. It's not a made up concern. And so when you're thinking strategically that, you know, you price that in and you think about where you're going. So, you know, that would be my sort of headline point. But will it be different? I mean, Sure, I think it will be different because I think that this is a president that, A, you know, he's got the Heritage Foundation plan to tell him what to do. He's got lots of people thinking about it. We know the adults in the room might not go back, but there are all sorts of people that have had time to really think about how they would use a Trump White House and a Trump executive branch and all the rest of it to make hay with their foreign policy priorities. But, you know, the number one issue where I think it has the highest stake is on climate and energy. I think that's sort of the, and especially domestically when it comes to the regulatory agenda, but also where you set people's sights and your vision of what's important, and that matters, right? Rhetoric matters and diplomacy matters. And secondly, on diplomacy, because if you think about, you know, the U.S. and China right now, what's the biggest risk of major outbreak of violence, conflict? It's that we misread each other's intentions, that we miscalculate because we read a signal wrong. How do you get around that? You do diplomacy in a serious, measured way. You try to build up trust. Biden's tried to do this with his team, especially with Bill Burns post-balloon. But I think the investment in diplomacy is the thing that in many ways is perhaps the most concerning one.
Let's come down the line on this.
Yeah. Okay, just a couple of things on how I think it'll be different. I think, one, the issue that you raised, tariffs. Yeah. They are committed to a 10 to 100% tariff on Chinese goods and a 10% tariff on every other export. And that, if they go through with it, and I think they'll try, would blow up the world trading system, as far as I know. I mean, Helen's the international political economist, but I don't see how the WTO, anything of that survives.
She thinks it's already gone.
Yeah. And so that's very big. And then I think the question is, how does the rest of the world respond to a Trump America? You've seen under Biden, certainly the European allies, partly because of Ukraine, you know, moving closer to the United States, Japan, where I've just spent a couple of months, same business. But I think if it's a Trump administration that is much more contemptuous of allies, much more openly protectionist, less willing to extend the American security guarantee, then the allies have a choice, you know, or have a question they face. Some will, I think Britain and others, will try to... They have no real option other than America. I think Britain and Japan are in that camp. But I think the US will pose a lot of Asian countries the question of saying, you know, it's us or China. And I think they may be surprised by the answer. I think quite a lot of the countries there will say, well, sorry, if you're going to force us to choose, you know, we're not going to move against China. So I think there could be a miscalculation in there. Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that's different is an aspect of the Middle East, and that is the Red Sea. Mm. Because if you go back to the Persian Gulf crisis of the summer and early autumn of 2019, when, amongst other things, the Houthis attacked a major Saudi oil facility, Trump did actually nothing. I mean, you could then say that the assassination of Soleimani at the beginning of the next year was a sort of belated response to that. But he did do a lot of tweeting, complaining about how the Americans were having to take responsibility for protecting freedom of navigation through the Persian Gulf, when he said 90% of the oil was going to China and Japan and to Europe, and why the hell was the United States like doing this? Now, clearly, and I think he sort of perhaps understood this, the Americans still actually do have a major oil interest in the Persian Gulf, because there's an international oil market, and the Americans can't detach themselves from the price of oil for the rest of the world, despite the shale boom. When it comes to the Red Sea, which obviously wasn't an issue in the same way at that time, the Americans don't have the same interest. The Red Sea and the Suez Canal, a rather small proportion of US trade is dependent upon that route. That's important for Europe, much more than it's important for the United States. Though, thus far, the Biden administration has been willing to use American naval force to protect essentially European economic interests in the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. Whether Trump will be might turn out to be a different question.
Interesting. So less of a commitment to the global commons in a way. Right.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So we're going to open it up. I'm going to take that person in the pink blazer. Person in the black, right afterwards, in the black sweatshirt, he'll come down. Go ahead. Please introduce yourself, and then I'll come up with you.
Thank you. My name is Selin Nasi. I'm a visiting fellow at LSE's European Institute. I have a question with regard to EU-UK relations. We had European elections were held last week. Given the current composition in the European Parliament and the strengthening of far-right in France and Germany, how do you see the future of EU-UK relations, especially with regard to defence cooperation? Do you, especially in the wake when the Labour Party is very likely to win the general election next month, do you think if that happens, the Labour Party will find a conducive environment in Europe to implement its foreign policy goals? And I believe the future of EU-UK relations, defence cooperation, gains significance in the backdrop of a potential Trump's potential return to the White House. Thank you very much.
Good to get a question about the UK. So, right down here. Yeah.
My name is Sophia. I come from mainland China. I guess that's why this is really the hot topic. So, regarding the international disorder, while the media outlets, whatever the topic related to China or the US or the Europe, pretty much in terms of like the power comes to the first or the very hated, debated the topic. So this is a international disorder. Then what would be the general trends regarding the international, the order, which in the world political and economic arena, what are the high income or the most influential economies and the mid power, the countries, what they could look at this, what they wish the international order would be? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So an international order question. Chris, an online question.
This question comes from Anthony, who's an LSE external alum. Whether Le Pen's party wins the French election or not, should Macron start thinking about strategic autonomy again, this time with potentially the UK or the EU joining the thinking or action? Thank you.
Mm. So that's a good question and a follow-on Trump, strategic autonomy. So who wants EU-UK relations?
Yeah, so, okay, so I think that that Starmer comes in. I mean, he's asked for the job, so I don't feel sorry for him. But there'll be he'll face an international situation that he wasn't really preparing for maybe a year ago. So that a lot of the Labour's economic policies seem to be a form of Me Tooism on Biden's economic policies. You know, that we're going to do a similar sort of thing, and this is the wave of the future. What Biden is doing, and now suddenly, you know, Biden's going to be gone probably. And how do they adapt to Trump? And similarly, Macron is obviously would have been a very congenial partner for a centre-left politician. Le Pen, much harder. But I think that they'll approach it through the prism of sort of hard-nosed national interests than face. They're going to have to give up on the idea that they have ideological bedfellows in Paris and Washington. They'll just say, OK, what is our national interest? How do we promote it? And as a matter of fact, you can see Labour already reaching out to Trump's people. David Lammy has met J.D. Vance a couple of times in Washington. They're talking to this guy, Elbridge Colby, who I don't think will get a job, but people think will. Mm-hmm. So that you can already see them beginning to adapt. And I think on more or less whoever comes in, Labour in France, Labour are going to try to make Britain's relative strength and defence, they're sort of key to reopening the European relationship. They've ruled out, as we know, single market, customs union, blah, blah, blah. But they're going to say, okay, given the security situation in Europe, the UK and the EU and the individual nations of the EU have a clear interest in much closer defence cooperation. Then they're going to try to define security in very broad terms, mm-hmm. so that it opens up a whole bunch of other things that you might not think of as security, and improve the relationship that way.
Yeah, I'll say something about the international economic order in China. I think there's something really complicated going on here, because we can tell a story, which I did in my opening answer, which is about how the international economy has become much more geopoliticized, that the international trading order in a rules-based sense through the WTO doesn't exist in the way in which it did previously. And that tends to lead to a conclusion that the world economically is deglobalizing. But actually, when you look at a number of other things, then that doesn't really stand up as an argument. That you actually haven't seen the big American firms like Apple leaving China. They've brought considerable resistance to the pressure on them from the Biden administration, perhaps before that, the Trump administration. China's exports are actually growing quite considerably to the rest of the world. And you might say that what we're actually seeing is a new drive of globalization around China's exports, paradoxically around the energy transition, the very thing that is driving, on the American side in particular, but now with the Commission proposing these new tariffs earlier in the week on Chinese cars, the reaction against globalization. And that's a huge new development, I think, and it means that the world, if Trump were to become president, that he would exist in is rather different than back in 2016. China was not a car manufacturing superpower then. It is on the way to becoming so now, and everybody is having to react to that. Now, at the moment, that's not having a significant impact on the American market, but it's clearly put the fear of God into the Biden administration, hence the 100% tariffs that are coming on those exports. We don't really know how that this is going to play out, and the fact that the Western governments want to be confrontational about it doesn't mean that their confrontation is actually going to change the actual trade part of the world economy. So we could have very weak rules, with the WTO being somewhat irrelevant, and at the same time, deepening interdependence.
Leslie. I'll just say very quickly, I agree with I think if I read it right, the general sense that the UK and Europe will try to work together regardless of which way the various elections go, in my view, on security and defence, trying to gain some sense of strategic autonomy with defence defined differently. But at the end of the day, really, it is about the US. And I think that there is no very serious short or medium term alternative. And so I don't begrudge, in fact, would encourage the next UK government already and in the future to work across the aisle in the US. It's a smart thing to do. And I actually do think Bridge Colby will get a job, and I actually think he's a pretty serious person worth talking to, and I'm sure you do too. With a serious book, and there are plenty of serious people on that want a job in the Trump administration, because they compartmentalize and there's time away from the event or events or the presidency. Doesn't mean that they're going to stay once they get there, or that they're going to enjoy it, or that they're not going to be confronted with some really serious problems, ethically and otherwise, and probably in terms of the policies that they'd like to see implemented once they're in.
I think one of the reasons he won't get a job is he is quite a serious person, but anyway.
Okay. And by the way, can I just say, the whole there is agency in this. Mm. You have a phenomenal platform, Gideon Rockman, and to say Biden will probably be out.
So it's down to me, thanks.
No, when you say Biden will probably be out, there's a lot of this going on, right?
Yeah, okay.
It's up for play. You can't just go, Biden will probably be out, without taking I consider you a friend, so I'll say it on the public platform, without taking some personal responsibility for the impact. Yeah, but you have a huge voice. You have a massive voice, and so it doesn't matter. I hear lots of people in the U.S. say, it'll be Trump, and do you know what many of them say? None of them are in Washington. People outside of Washington, it'll be Trump. How will your life change? It won't change very much. Well, people who are kind of upper middle income Americans say, well, actually, maybe we'll be a bit wealthier. Which isn't to say that they want him. Most of them that I talk to don't, but they don't think it's going to harm their everyday life, which is an interesting thing too.
I'm going to go back out on the strategic autonomy question. I would just say if Trump is elected and Macron is still around, that'll get some new altitude. It'll get some traction in Europe. Because Trump won is one thing. Trump's the second time. I think what most Europeans, and probably I spend a lot of time in Asia as well, the conclusion would be the United States has fundamentally changed. Let's go to the gentleman in the it's a leather jacket, I think. Right, let's start there.
Hi there, Phil Woodford. I'm an alumnus of the school. There's been obviously a little bit of disagreement over how the Trump-Biden thing's going to play out. How much of a curveball is Robert Kennedy Jr. in a close election? His sort of cranky agenda seems to appeal to both Trump and Biden supporters.
Clearly a curveball. So how about in the back up there with the hand up next to the wall?
Thank you. My name is Sakshi. I'm a master's student here at the LSC studying human rights and politics. I wanted to ask, has the utter lack of respect or response to the ICC and the ICJ outcomes and statements regarding Palestine from the West shaken the Global South's trust in the West to be able to uphold an international rule-based order? And especially given that these international courts and international law was set up by the Western powers in the first place. And kind of briefly building up on Professor Leslie's point that was mentioned, how has the Biden administration's incredibly disappointing response to genocide and the student demonstrations, for example, at Columbia, shaken the left liberal support that the Democrats would have ideally just depended upon? Has that tipped the scales? Has it changed the support that these parties would get? Yeah, I would love to hear about that.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, and now we're going to go online again. Yeah.
This is from Taku Smith, who is a GCSE student at Warwick. What are the panel's thoughts on the AFD? How big of an issue are they? Thank you.
Okay.
Peter, can I encourage you to take Robert F. Kennedy, since you're them? You're the American politics professor here.
All right, you start with the other ones, and I'll think about the answer. So go ahead.
It just gives me an opportunity for a massive name drop. So I was in South Africa last week and saw Ramaphosa and asked him about what he thought of whether South Africa was in danger of isolating itself, a different approach to it, because there is a threat to South Africa's trade privileges with the US. They get tariff-free access. A lot of the kind of right-wingers in Congress have begun to threaten that because of South Africa's support for the ICC process and the genocide case. And he said that they took some encouragement from the fact that quite a lot of European countries have now become joined the case. I think Ireland, Slovenia, Sweden, possibly, I can't remember. He had a list. And so that suggests that there isn't a kind of unified Western response on these issues. I mean, I think he may be not complacent, but I think if the Trump people come in, they may go after South Africa on this case. And I think that it's one of the sort of paradoxes of the liberal position. I grant you enormous disappointment with what Biden has done or not done on Palestine, but I think Trump would be far worse. I think that if you look at the way that, I do know that the people in the White House agonize, albeit rather ineffectually, about what's going on in Gaza. There'll be no agonizing from the Trump people. If you look at the way Pompeo embraced the more radical elements in Israel on this. I think that it's true that the West sort of sponsored some of these institutions, but the US has never been signed up to the ICC. But neither has China, neither has India, neither has Russia. Great powers don't, because they don't want to be constrained by international law. So I don't think the West is alone in having, not giving full backing to the idea of international legal order that constrains things. Look at Putin's indictment. And I think that final thought on this, that one of the kind of slightly spooky echoes of the 1920s and 30s that's going on is the destruction of high-minded liberal institutions, international institutions, that were put in place in the hope that they would constrain people's behavior. And you saw the League of Nations basically just fall apart in those years. And we may be seeing the same thing happening with the ICC, the ICJ, and moving just back from a sort of rules-based order to a power-based order.
Leslie, you're itching to jump in.
I thought you might have far forgotten my name there for a minute.
No.
I'll add a couple things to that. One is, it's true that great powers haven't joined the International Criminal Court, but they don't all say that they believe in human rights and democracy and liberalism and global values and multilateralism, and the United States does. And so the standard that people set for America is much higher when it comes to pushing back against the ICC or the ICJ, very different institutions nonetheless, than they set for China or even India, which have been very clear. It's about sovereignty. It's not about human rights. If it's about human rights, it's about development, economic and social, and not about political and civil. The other thing is, Gideon's exactly right. The Republicans will be much worse, and they have been in the past. The Republicans in the past have gone to great lengths to try and limit the power of the International Criminal Court. This wouldn't be the first time. The silver lining of this story, even though the U.S. is obviously not behind, because it can't be for a variety of political reasons, the ICC case with respect to Israel, is that the Biden administration did decide not to jump on board the sanctions. And that was that took a few days to get there. And that does come down to agency.
Sanctions people. On the ICC.
Exactly. And, the initial reaction was very negative, right, calling out the ICC. But they did pause, and they listened to the people said, don't do this. And Beth Van Chock, the U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes in the State Department, very strong advocate of human rights, transitional justice, accountability. The International Criminal Court has worked very hard to make sure that the U.S. is supportive. She's obviously in a tough place, but it's been a more measured reaction than it might have been. But to the basic question that you asked, of course it's caused deep, deep pushback from much of the rest of the world against America's hypocrisy. It's not new, it's much worse right now. And it was already the case. It's already been the case now for several months, but this was another very serious layer on top of that. I think, though, that it's elites that are watching the ICC and ICJ story, but I think a lot of people, everyday people, are watching the bigger story, which is about what the deaths in Gaza right now.
Helen? On the AFD, I think that there's two ways of looking at this. The first is to be quite encouraged that they didn't do anywhere near it. As well as the polling even 6 months ago would suggest, so that would be an AFD that could get into the 20s rather than be around the 15% level. If you look at actual elections in Germany when they come, they're not getting past that. The counter to that is that they had a terrible campaign, is that we have seen as people in the party caught up in major corruption and espionage scandal. They were thrown out of the Identity and Democracy grouping by Le Pen during the course of the election campaign, and they did very well in East Germany, particularly among young voters, and that there will be significant state elections in the eastern part of Germany over the next year. And if you had a breakthrough for the AfD in one of those elections, that would be another matter. But I do think that they're a party that, shall we say, organisationally is a lot less together than either Le Pen's party in France or Meloni's party in Italy. And that, in that sense, is a bit encouraging.
Yeah. And then they've seemed to have moved in a different trajectory, in that the Maloney and Le Pen have moved towards the centre, and if anything, the Radicals and the AfD have won and are now, you know, having sort of scary meetings by lakes in Berlin talking about mass deportation.
Yes, you know. RFK, couple quick thoughts about RFK. So the first thing is that historically third-party candidates in the United States lose traction, altitude, the closer you get to the election. This was even true of Ross Perot, who won 19% of the vote. I mean, that was a big, big number. You'd have to go back to the 19th century to look for something comparable, to find something comparable. That's the first thing to say. I think the second thing maybe to say is that, and you pointed this out in the question, is RFK is drawing support from both Biden, in a sense, and Trump. Trump seems to be more concerned, the Trump campaign, about RFK has really attacked him. The thing about RFK is what he's basically attracting, or what are called, what American political consultants call, the double haters. That is, they basically hate both Biden and Trump, and they're looking for an alternative. And it's a non-trivial portion of the electorate. In a close election, you know, these, and what we're probably headed to is an election that'll be decided by a few states. Probably you could, I mean, if you take the last election where it was essentially decided by 70,000 voters in two states, Georgia and Arizona. This one will probably be decided in the blue states, I mean in the Rust Belt states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and perhaps Wisconsin. And I think there, it's not RFK that will make the difference. It's perhaps, I mean, I think one possibility are the fringe parties, the Greens, and even potentially Cornel West, for Biden, and for Trump, the Libertarians, because it gives people an out that don't want to vote for Trump, but damn well don't want it to be the first time in their lives that they voted for a Democrat. So, anyway, I think we've kind of reached the bewitching hour. I didn't mean to be the closing part of this, I want to thank everybody for coming here. It's great turnout. And please join me in thanking the panel. The panel was terrific.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.